everybody, and welcome to another episode of Book Goodies, the podcast by authors for authors. I'm one of your hosts, Deborah Kearney, and I'm joined today by our other host,
Karen Garcia.
And today we have with us author Ken Levine. Hi, Ken. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, we love to have people, to talk to people about their books, and particularly about memoirs, because I think it's a slice of history that is really important for people to be able to have access to. So, Ken, why don't you give us a little bit of background on yourself, and then we'll talk about your book.
Okay, well, I have sort of a unique background in that I've had a number of different careers. My main career was as a TV comedy writer, and I was the head writer on MASH for a while.
Oh, my
and
God.
Produced Cheers for 9 years, and Frasier, and wrote on The Simpsons, and Wings, and Becker, and...
I love Wings! Wings was...
With my partner, David Isaacs, we co-wrote the movie Volunteers with Tom Hanks, and then there's my other career, which is a baseball announcer.
Okay.
And I'm currently one of the play-by-play announcers of the Seattle Mariners, and I also worked for the San Diego Padres and Baltimore Orioles and part of the Los Angeles Dodger broadcast crew. So that's, in a nutshell, my basic background. And the book is a labor of love. I've been lucky enough to grow up in Southern California during that period of the 60s. And I was having lunch with a high school friend a few years ago, and we were lamenting the fact that there were no books about what it was like to really live in the 60s. That any book that you ever read about the 60s all reads like a history book.
Right.
Then Kennedy was assassinated, then the Beatles, then the hippies, then the war, then the moon landing, and it never really gets into the basics of what it was like if you were a kid growing up in that period. And all of those events obviously did take place, and did have a major effect on all of us, but they all took place in the background. And for those of us growing up in the 60s, it was really about discovering great music and trying to go to the beach and trying to get lucky and get jobs and get into good colleges and getting high and what to do about the draft. And so I thought, well, okay, I'm going to write my memoir. Nothing particularly astounding happened to me. I didn't drop out and move to Haight-Ashbury and become a hippie, and I didn't become a student revolutionary and burn down banks or go to Woodstock. But you know what? The truth is, 99.9999% of us didn't do any of those things. So this is really kind of a book about, more about your basic nerd in high school, and how I came to find myself through the decade, and along the way sort of shape my personality, and it's what led me into being a comedy writer. So in a nutshell, that's really what the book is about.
That's awesome. I really need to research the people that I'm going to be interviewing a little bit more. I didn't know you did any of those things.
I'm so excited when you said that.
So I could have said anything then, right?
No, I can look you up and make sure to fact check.
Oh, okay. All right. I was
nobody's
the governor of Iowa for a few years, and...
Nobody's tried to pull anything over on us yet, because after
I've been on
the podcast, I've been able to fact check. But you wrote, of course, you know that those are some of the greatest sitcoms ever. And it's really funny because Wings is now showing up on some of the channels when we go channel surfing. And we just saw the one where, and you'll have to forgive me because my brain is forgetting details, but it's where the little Italian guy is trying to sing Row Your Boat Ashore.
Uh-huh.
And he had the weird lyrics for it, and then he found out the right ones, and then the blonde is like, he started playing it like every day over and over again, and the blonde was like, okay, they've rowed long enough. So, yeah, those are some really fun TVs.
Yeah, no, those were fun shows to be a part of, absolutely.
Well, and being comedy writers, you must have had fun in the back room, just like, you know, I can imagine the things that didn't make it to the screen.
Oh, yes, yes. For every joke that did make it to the screen, there were probably 10 or 15 filthy, jaw-dropping, inappropriate, politically incorrect, horrible, sexist, terrible jokes that were pitched. Yes.
And especially with MASH, with, oh.
Hawkeye.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a very fun character to write for.
Yeah. No, we've actually rediscovered it on reruns on cable, and for a while it was gone.
I could use the residuals.
Yeah, really.
Well, it was gone for such a long time, but we used to watch it all the time. And you know, I'm a child of the late 70s, so I missed the original viewing of all that. But I remember watching it as a child, and you know, my parents watched Cheers, and so de facto, as the one television in the house happened to be on, that's what I watched too.
Right.
And so I grew up on those shows, so I'm super excited. And I watched Dharma and Greg when it was around too. So
I directed that. Yeah.
Directed that,
and Everybody Loves Raymond, and Becker, and a lot of things.
Yeah. So your second book is going to be about your television career.
Well, yeah, that book is coming. That book, you know, I have to sell enough copies of this.
Right.
So, by being on this show, I'm probably going to make it to the New York Times bestseller list, I would imagine.
You never know. You
right.
never know. We did a podcast with a, and you'll understand this because it's a current event. We did a podcast 2 weeks ago with a person that was a follower of Reverend Moon. And when Reverend Moon passed away on Sunday, Karen, like, we hadn't posted the show yet, and Karen was like, he died! Get the podcast up!
Oh, that sounds so horrible. I mean, he made me sound like an ambulance chaser.
No. But it's the fact that, you know, there are some times that you can hook up on to current events and be able to get some extra attention for the author that wrote the book. And,
right.
you know, his podcast, it was the highest podcast listenership for the first 24 hours that a podcast was posted. So, and it was partly the fact that, you know, we do rank for certain things. And, you know, when people did searches, they found our post and they found him. And what a lot of authors aren't good at that we are, and this isn't bragging, it's just, you know, fact, is that they aren't good at creating a website or a presence that is highly search engine friendly.
Right.
That's one
of the things. Well, I have a website.
Okay, cool.
The website is megenerationbook.com.
MeGenerationBook.com,
and in it, it's just loaded with pictures, family pictures, and just general pictures of the 60s, and there's a lot of videos, a lot of crazy videos of old commercials and health films and all kinds of goofy stuff, so... yeah, it's a nice trip in the Wayback Machine.
Well, and like I said, you're capturing a piece of history, and you're doing it in a fun way instead of in, like you said, the dry, you know, these are all the bad things that happened in the 60s, and, you know, you're capturing it from the point of view from the other 99%. And
right.
That
and
is something important.
The truth is, it was a very exciting, fun time to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was also very turbulent,
mm-hmm.
but you know, we had the surfing scene here in Southern California, and also with the Sunset Strip and Laurel Canyon, this was really kind of the center of new music with the Doors and, you know, all of the groups, Buffalo Springfield and the Byrds and Mamas and Papas and all of the groups that came out of Southern California. So it was really exciting. I saw the Doors and the Jefferson Airplane perform at a high school football stadium.
Wow.
Before they became really big. So it was really fun. It was, you know, confusing times. I mean, you know, all kids are trying to sort of figure out their place in the world, and that is a difficult task under normal conditions. And then when you throw in the fact that the ground was shifting underneath you daily, and that, you know, there were so many, you know, shifts in ideals and, you know, and then, you know, styles changed and, you know, drugs and college. And I mean, there was so much stuff that went on. If you look at the beginning of the decade, we were all kind of like Ozzy and Harriet, you know,
right,
where everybody was clean cut and you'd go to a school dance and the boys all wore ties. And, you know, by the end of the decade, you know, we're all long haired hippies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And drugs were so available and the consequences were not known yet. So it was,
well,
such
they were suspected. Yeah, they were suspected. I have to be honest and say that I didn't do a lot of drugs. I was one of those people who is still just a little petrified of LSD and taking bad trips and, you know, finding myself, you know, naked, you know, running down Hollywood Boulevard out of my mind. So so I didn't do that. I did smoke a little pot in my day.
I think it
so
was
I
a
probably
prerequisite.
Can't run for president.
I think it was a prerequisite in Venice Beach. I took a trip there a few years ago, and literally you went from house to house, and everybody had a bong sitting down on the kitchen table. And I'm like, really? Don't you hide
these
things?
Yeah, we're not in Kansas anymore, Dorothy.
Yeah, and that was now, so I can imagine what it was like back then. It was just like flowing everywhere.
Yeah, it was like a purple haze. I remember the first time that I was on the Sunset Strip, and it was probably like 1966 or so, and there was this distinctive smell in the air, and you never forget your first secondhand reefer smoke, you know, and that kind of became, you know, if there is ever one, you know, scent of the decade, it was probably that, because I would go to Love-In's at the park, and obviously, you know, college and dorm rooms were just a giant opium den.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was the smell of marijuana. But, you know, the other thing, too, about the time is that, you know, we all, well, number one, we were the largest generation that the world had ever known. 76 million of us, at least half of us intended. And Madison Avenue and the TV networks and everybody catered to us because we were such a large force in the population.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of nice to go through stages and always be catered to. When we were kids, there were kid shows on TV. When we were teenagers, there were dance party shows on TV. And there was radio stations that that catered to us. And so that made us feel kind of special. And the second thing is that we all grew up at a time. It was post-World War II, and the economy was starting to rebound, and we really all believed that we could do whatever we wanted to do, that whatever career we decided to pursue, that there would be a place for us. And it was a time of much greater optimism than there is now. I mean, I think it's harder to be a kid in 2012 than it was in 1965. And that's kind of sad. But, you know, hopefully the kids of today would read a book like this. And number one, it would kind of give them some insight into what their parents were like when they were growing up.
they're going to read the book and they're going to go, "You did that?"
Yeah, exactly. And I think what they're going to find is that, you know, when we grew up, the anxiety that we had and the experiences that we had and the joys and the rejection and the goals and all of the things that we had when we were teenagers are pretty much the same as what the teenagers are going through now. We didn't have cell phones and we didn't have iPads, but the emotions are the same, you know, going after girls and being nervous about it and, you know, just that whole era of teenage life and teenage angst, it was all very similar. And so hopefully, even if you didn't grow up in the 60s, if you grew up in the 60s, then there's going to be a lot of things that are going to jog personal memories. And if you didn't grow up in the 60s, hopefully it will immerse you in that period and you'll get a sense of what it was like kind of going into a time machine. And I think you'll be able to identify and see that so much of what other generations went through, we went through as well.
I love that concept, and I like that take on a book. And you already told us why you wrote the memoir, and you're telling us a little bit more now. How hard was it to actually, you know, at what point did you say, look, I have to do this? And then how did you figure out how to structure it?
Well, I thought about it for a couple of months, and I started doing research. I managed to dig up my high school annuals, and there are some wonderful websites that have detailed timelines. You can go back and find any specific week of the 1960s, and it will tell you what songs were popular, what the news of the day was, what music was going on, what movies were playing, and that sort of thing. So I basically spent a number of months just kind of cobbling together a timeline. And when I felt I had enough to go on, that the book wouldn't be really superficial, then I just sat down and started writing it. And at first it was really kind of an experiment to see whether this was something that I enjoyed or whether this was something that would resonate for anybody, you know, much less myself. And
right.
And the more I wrote it, the more I really enjoyed it. I really kind of got into it. And I started interviewing fellow classmates and getting more insight from them. And I worked in a record store and have this sort of encyclopedic mind where I remember all the songs from the 60s, all the songs, all the artists, when they came out, in most cases, the labels. It's a completely useless skill.
Very envious of you.
You know, in most cases. But that really helped, too, because I associated people and events with certain songs. And so it was very easy to cross-check and see when those songs were popular. And so, like I said, I just cobbled together a timeline and then started writing. And I have a pretty good memory of which girls rejected me in high school, because most of them did. So that was pretty easy. And then once I started writing it, I found it was on one level, it was very cathartic. And it was, like, a lot of fun and very nostalgic. And on the other, it was sort of painful to relive some of those memories. But all in all, it was a lot of fun. And, you know, look, along the way, I you know, I did some pretty interesting things. My first girlfriend was Ann Jillian.
Nice.
Yeah. Of course, we were 13 at the time.
But
so
still.
So when I say we dated, you know, we went to the Corbin Bowl and
right.
went bowling. It's not like I got her liquored up and took her to the Howard Johnson's.
Right.
And then, as I mentioned, I worked in a record store in the San Fernando Valley called Wallach's Music City. And we had this feature called Listening Booth, where you could go into this little glass cubicle that had a turntable, and you could listen to albums without having to buy them.
Right.
Which is like crack for a teenager. And Neil Young from Buffalo Springfield,
mm-hmm.
he used to come down from Laurel Canyon, and he would come to Wallach's, and like once a week I'd have to throw him out of the listening booth because our one rule was no smoking pot, and you know he'd be smoking pot, and these listening booths served as the store windows.
So, oh, right.
You know, that wasn't too cool, having, you know, people display illegal activities in the booth. Plus, you know, the contact high, you know, when Neil Young left and some 76-year-old grandmother came in to, you know, preview her Montavani album, and then she'd get, like, completely stoned through Neil Young. So, yeah, so I threw Neil Young out of the listening booths, you know, all the time. So, you know, different things like that. I worked at a radio station and got a chance to go to Laugh-In and got a chance to, let's just say I saw a part of Goldie Hawn long before Kurt Russell did.
I was just going to say, Goldie Hawn was the one that, because she was so ditzy, it was like, is she really this ditzy? And as a kid, you don't realize that maybe she's on something or, you know, whatever. You're just saying, wow, she's really ditzy. And then, you know, we all know that when you watch the Dean Martin show that he was totally liquored up and smoking and everything, but Goldie Hawn was just like, you know?
Yeah.
And then she would totally forget her line, and you could see that someone told it to her from somewhere else, and then she would do the joke, and, you know, and all of them were, you know, just really spacey and funny, and that had to be a really interesting show to be on the set of.
Yes.
Because that was all live, wasn't it?
No.
It was
no.
taped, but
they,
it was...
No, they taped a lot of it. These were blackouts. You know, my first job, my first potential writing job, was Laugh-In. I was 19 years old, and I was offered a full time job to be a comedy writer for Laugh-In for like $50,000, which is, you know, when you're 19.
That's
in,
a lot
you know,
of
1969 is a fortune. But I had to turn it down because I would lose my 2S deferment. And in 5 months, I'd be over in Vietnam. So
mm-hmm.
It killed me, but I had to turn that down.
Couldn't you have taken it and told them you were going to write from Canada? Not going to go over. Oh, well.
Yeah, no, you know, they wanted you there every day. I said, can I do this part-time? They said, no, this is like a full-time job. So
You've got a pretty impressive resume already.
Yeah, well, I do. At the time, I didn't. At the time, you know, it was Wally's Music City and sports intern at KMPC. So, you know, it was a lot of fun. I Gary Owens, who was on Laugh-In,
mm-hmm.
remember he was the announcer.
Yep.
Gary worked at this radio station that I interned for, and I used to write comedy material for Gary for his show, and he was nice enough to save all of my bits and submit them to the producer of Laugh-In.
Nice.
Who really liked it. Oh, yeah, one day I'm home, and I get a call that George Slaughter, the producer of Laugh-In, wants me to meet him. I'm like, what? Why? And so I go down to Burbank, and he offers me this job, which unfortunately I couldn't take.
Now,
I was also thrown off the dating game.
You were thrown off it?
I was thrown off the dating game, yeah.
Why did they throw you off?
Well, my father at the time was a radio salesman for KABC Radio in Los Angeles, and the dating game was on ABC. And when I went on my very first interview to the dating game, I mentioned that, and I said, look, if there's a conflict of interest and there's a problem, then I'll just go home and I'll save everybody a lot of time if I'm just not eligible to participate in the show. They said, no, no, that's fine. In fact, we've even had instances where our own staff has had to fill in and go on the air. So I was like, okay. So I went through the audition process where they ask you inane questions, and I guess my inane answers were funny inane answers. And so the next day I get a call to go on the dating game. So I went on the dating game, and I lost, but I really didn't care because my objective was to score and get big laughs. I'm on national television. So so I was funny, and like I said, I lost and got like 4,000 tubes of Gleam toothpaste. I think I still have some. If you guys need any toothpaste, I can set you up. And then they called me back for the alumni show. Uh-huh. And I went on the alumni show, and again, I was really funny. And shortly after that, I got a call to be on the nighttime dating game show. And the nighttime dating game show, if you remember, the dates were trips to Paris and Hawaii.
Yes.
You know,
Chuck Woolery,
when you
right?
went on the daytime show, you got to be the grand marshal at the Indio Date Festival. It's like, who gives a crap? But on the nighttime show, that was like, you know, unbelievable. And I'd never even been on an airplane at the time. So I was really geeked up to win that. And at the time, there was a strike, and a lot of executives would be manning the cameras and things like that. And we had like a dress rehearsal where they just kind of walk us through. And one of the cameramen recognized me and knew my dad and mentioned it to somebody. And this got relayed to Chuck Barris, the creator of the dating game and also the CIA spy. And and so he threw me off.
Nice.
Wow.
You were already ready to go. You'd already been on the show.
Yeah, they just threw me off. And, you know, I might have won a trip to Barcelona.
Yeah.
So that was traumatic.
Yeah. But, you know, you bring up another good point, and the fact is that you also grew up in an era where everybody in Los Angeles had to end up in show business. There were, like, no other jobs.
Well, yeah, it's true. I mean, there were some other jobs. They were making rocket engines nearby, and as a result, we had Nike missiles in our neighborhood protecting us, which was, you know, a lot better than, you know, those rent-a-cop, you know, Westinghouse burglary, you know, protection agencies.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, there were a lot of people in the industry, and that was... That was kind of fun. I remember as a kid, this was before the 60s, when I played Little League, I was in my 50s, and I was on the same team as Bob Crane's son, you know, Bob Crane from Hogan's Heroes, and later, you know, his, you know, Dark World of Porno. But he was like one of those fathers that, like, you know, yells at people. And I remember missing a play, and I'm at first base, and there's Bob Crane, like, swearing at me. I'm like eight. I'm like eight. And it's like, hey, geez, you know, it's Bob Crane, you know.
It's crazy.
Colonel Hogan is
yeah, Colonel Hogan's yelling at me.
He's calling me every name in the book. I'm eight, okay?
Oh,
screw
man.
You.
But, you know, it was a very interesting time. And you, I mean, I can tell you, it's got to be well written, because this has been already so much fun. What advice would you give to someone that was thinking about writing their memoir?
The advice I would give is be honest about yourself. The one rule that I adhere to was to not create an idealized character of myself. And there are stupid things I do in the book, and there are immature things I do in the book. There are poor decisions that I make during the book, and there are things that I am inadequate at. And I just felt if you're going to do it, be real and be honest. And if you're going to do a memoir, show yourself warts and all, which was kind of the hard part to, you know, reveal to people, you know, some of the stupid things that you did and, you know, things that you regret. But ultimately, I think it worked to my advantage, and this wasn't by design. This just worked out this way. But I think, you know, I learned a lot about how I grew during that period just by seeing the way I reacted to situations when I was 13 versus the way I reacted to similar situations when I was 18 and 19. And so I think it helps sort of show my growth. But the only way to show my growth is to show my immaturity along the way. And so that's, you know, the one thing I would suggest. One of the things I decided to do in the book was, in many cases, I use pseudonyms for different people.
Mm-hmm.
And my reasoning for that was, again, I wanted to be 100% honest, and I didn't want to embarrass anybody. And, you know, the point of this book was not to get back at people, although you'll read there's a few people in the book that deserve getting, you know, their revenge. you know, who among us, when we were 13 and 14 and 15, didn't do stupid things or react in a cruel way to somebody?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, now that we're grown-ups, we look back at and, you know, and are mortified. So I felt it was important to protect their anonymity.
And that's another question that we usually do ask folks, that some people I know that we've interviewed have used pen names even to protect their own identity in order to be completely honest about the memoir they were writing, in addition to changing the names of the people in the story, because otherwise they wouldn't have been able to write it at all. And I know that the majority of people, though, are doing what you do, which is you use your real name, you know, to write your book, and then you change names and don't use last names and, you know, change situations around so that people won't be directly hurt by what you have to say and about what you recalled. And you need to do that so that you can, like you said, be totally honest. Because you don't want to whitewash things. And if part of the point of your book is to show kids that, you know, even back in the 60s, people made, you know, your parents made bad decisions, and, you know, and to have other people in that lived through that time zone take your book seriously as being authentic, you have to show, like you said, you have to show warts and all, or else people will be like, well, that's not how it really was.
Right. I think people can smell out a bogus book in a minute. I really think they can. And if people don't react the way people normally do, I think a reader's radar goes off. And so, you know, that again, my point was not to write a book to get people to love me or think that I was, you know, Hawkeye at 16, because I wasn't Hawkeye at 16, you know. I was Radar at 16.
Us geeks loved Radar.
What?
Us geeks loved Radar.
Exactly, exactly. I was a geek before they were fashionable.
Exactly.
Yeah. But, I mean, I talk about the fact that, especially in my early teens, I was just absolutely clueless when it came to women. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a family of boys. I have a younger brother. And girls were from Mars, just these mysterious creatures. And you add to the fact that girls reach that age, and when they go through adolescence, you know, they become one raw, exposed nerve, and everything is drama, and, you know, all of the angst that they go through, and I was just completely baffled.
You and everybody else in your grade.
yeah, exactly.
So now, Karen, do you have any questions? Because you weren't around at all during that time period.
I wasn't, you know, and so for me, it's, you know, I have a feeling this would be a really interesting read for me. You know, my mom grew up in Eastern Oregon and kind of in the middle of nowhere, so it's a completely different lifestyle than living in LA, obviously. And my dad grew up, you know, here in the Mid Valley in California, up near Sacramento, and so again, totally different situation. And, you know, my parents have always been very upfront with me, and their experience with, you know, the drug culture and the hippie culture and things like that was completely non-existent because of where they grew up. So,
right.
You know, it's a very foreign concept to me because honestly, I mean, I don't even have any friends that are potheads or anything like that because I don't associate with anyone like that. Never have, never plan to. So I think that that sort of memoir that pulls in something that I'm unfamiliar with is incredibly compelling because there are other things that happen than just my little tiny circle of the world. And it's not all about Vietnam and it's not all about, you know, Woodstock and things like that. So I'm definitely interested in finding out more about what else happened.
Yeah, like I said, all of these events did happen, mm-hmm. but what they don't really tell you about is, you know, how we all dealt with it and
right.
what our reaction were to things and mm-hmm. And what effect they had on the mood of the country. I mean, you know, we had all these assassinations. In the early part of the 60s, we lived with the Cold War and the Missiles of October in 1962 when the world came to the very brink of World War III and
right.
what it was like, you know, for me, I'm 12 years old and I'm thinking to myself, I'm going to die at 12 years old. What did I ever do to the Soviet Union? You
right.
know? So yeah, there's like all kinds of things that go on beyond just the headlines. And, so hopefully
The headlines are the only thing that make it into, you know, the educational history book that you get
right.
stuck with in high school, and it's like a chapter,
right.
maybe, you know?
Right.
And so it's, you know, the concentration is always on, you know, the Kennedy assassination or the Bay of Pigs or something like that, but it's always those really high level, you know, this horrible thing happened or this horrible thing almost happened, but none of the day-to-day life of, you know, of a child, you know, what was your experience? How did it affect you growing up, and what was your take on it? Because it's going to be totally different than some talking head, you know, from a newspaper.
Right. And another thing that
different.
Was so important in the life of a teenager back then was the radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's where we got our music, and as opposed to today, where everybody has their own playlist and they can sort of design their own radio station, Pandora, we all had this common radio station that we all listened to, and we all heard new music at the same time, and the radio was our constant companion. And a survey taken in the 60s showed that disc jockeys were perceived of by teenagers as being more trustworthy than your parents or policemen or clergy.
Yep, they were very powerful during that time period.
Yeah,
and the other thing I want to bring up for now, like you said, you were 12. I was more around like eight to 10 years old during the early 60s when that whole, you know, like I can picture exactly where I was when Kennedy was shot. I know, you know, what was going on during Bay of Pigs. I also, you also indel upon your head, like your mother, my mother was like, turn the lights off, close the curtains. You know, there's riots going on, like just a few blocks from our house, you know, high.
Right.
And then the other thing that became was the blackouts. Everybody has to turn out. I mean, we're in Rochester, New York. We're not anywhere near a coast. However, we had some pretty big companies there that built arms. So we were actually a target. And my mother would be.
So were we. So did you guys have big Nike missiles in your neighborhood too?
Yeah, we had GE, we had Kodak. They were all making, you know, missiles and bombs and whatever. You know, they were all working on that technology back then, and they were all, like, not very far from where I lived. I mean, literally, like, 5 miles.
And Kodak was making bombs?
Yeah. And
seriously?
Kodak was very big in the war industry, and so was General Electric. You know, we thought they were making paper.
Well, the thing is about the Kodak bombs is they would detonate, but then you had to wait for a week for them to be processed.
I love it.
It would take a week. You know, they would drop a bomb, but then you had to wait a week for it to actually blow up.
That's pretty cool. But what was really funny though, how far into people's minds they got with the your house has to be dark. You can't have your lights on. You have to have your curtains closed. You know, the Russians are going to send the Russians are coming. I remember standing in my kitchen and my mother looking at me saying, we have to keep all the curtains closed and keep everything dark because the Russians are coming tonight. And I'm like, why are they coming to Rochester?
Wow, that night?
Yeah, why are they coming to Rochester?
Hopefully you had some borscht.
I know, why are they coming tonight? You know, and I'm like 10 years old thinking, why? But it was and that was from the news. You know, like you were living in an area where there was more openness. I was in Rochester's a relatively small city compared to L.A. or New York. And it's like, you know, all we knew was what were the headlines. And back then, headlines had to be sensational to sell papers. So, you know, the headline would be the Russians are coming and these are the precautions you need to take. And you know, because it was all very quiet about about GE and Kodak and all that. And I didn't learn about it until I got older. And all of a sudden, they lost their contracts and they started shutting down because there was no war anymore.
Right.
And no Cold
War. So let me ask you, did you scream up and jump up and down with the Beatles? did you have all these Beatles posters in your room? And
Bobby Sherman.
Were you like totally nutso over the Beatles? Be honest.
The Beatles, I bought their first record. I wasn't a screaming type of a girl, but I went to a Bobby Sherman concert, and who I thought was a really cool girl from school and everything was standing next to me screaming and crying and jumping up and down. And the only thing I heard of the whole concert were the opening three stanzas that he sang, because after that, the entire concert, and I was right up front, entire concert with nothing but screaming teenagers. And I'm like, I came to a concert to hear him, not hear all of you. But, right. Yeah, I had the posters all over my bedroom walls of all the Cassidys and the, you know, all those, all the Tiger Beat. You know, you had to buy the newest Tiger Beat, take out all the posters, put them on the walls. Yeah, my heartthrob was Bobby Sherman.
Okay.
Because he was on that TV show and he had a stutter and everybody felt bad for him. I don't even remember the name of the TV show now. They never show it in reruns.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, that was part of the issue growing up is, you know, I had to compete with, you know, the Beatles and, mm-hmm. you know, and the Bobby Shermans and, you know, the Monkees.
Oh.
The various heartthrobs.
Of course.
You know.
We all love the Monkees and their funny antics, and they were hysterical, and, you know, they were a put-together band and all that controversy about that they weren't really musicians, and we were like, I don't care, it's entertaining.
Right, right.
So
all that stuff is in the book, and all the stuff about the Sunset Strip and, you know, the music scene and... all the, you know, the whole surf scene. And, I mean, it was really cool, like I said, growing up in Los Angeles. You know, you'd watch cowboy movies, and all of those cowboy movies were filmed not too far from where I lived in the San Fernando Valley. And, you know, you're used to seeing movie stars, and you're used to seeing things being filmed in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of fun to this day where I'll see a movie that was filmed in 1967 and they'll drive by familiar streets.
Right.
You know, and it's like being in a time machine. Like, oh, my God. Oh, man, that's Van Nuys Boulevard.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's Bob's Big Boy. I remember that. So.
Well, and what's really funny, too, about that is the first time I went to L.A., you know, I'm like, wow, I'm on Sunset Strip. Oh, look, this is the canal where they drove, or whatever they call it, the river, where there's no water. And they all drove, you know, that's where they drove the hot rods and all the beach movies and all the races.
Right, right.
And I'm like, I'm right here. This really all exists because you figure it's all a big, you know, a big movie set. And Los Angeles is one big movie set.
Well, I mean, everything is so new in Los Angeles. You know, that's the thing, too. I mean, I love, even to this day, when you'll see a restaurant that says, you know, established 1983, as if that's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go to New York and, you know, established 1641.
Well, not quite, but close.
Yeah, that's a little late there, but yeah, I remember going to Keene's in New York, and it's incredibly old steakhouse, and you know, it's all this history and everything. If something said that, you know, hey, we were founded in the 80s, I would look around at the decor and make sure they'd be decorated. That would be the important thing there.
George Washington never slept at the Holiday Inn on Ventura Boulevard at Topanga Canyon.
No. And what's really also really funny about the whole area there is that everything is, I mean, it seems to be a sprawling area, but it is all, like, right there. You know, like Laurel Canyon and Studio City and all this stuff is, like, really close together. And then, you know, Venice Beach is a little ways out, but it's all... It really is, like, all right. Santa Monica, you know, everything is, like, right there and easy to get to. And
it was easier to get to back then, too, because there were fewer people.
I was going to say, less traffic.
Yeah, less traffic. And you're right. I mean, I grew up in the West San Fernando Valley, and I would go over Malibu Canyon and go to the beach. That would take me 20 minutes to a half an hour. In 15 minutes, I could be in Laurel Canyon. In half an hour, I could be in Westwood or Hollywood. It was easier to get around back then. And boy, back then, cars were everything.
Yeah.
Everything. Yeah. Having your car meant having your independence. And, you know, I mean, that's the difference between, say, L.A. and East Coast cities like New York and
yeah,
Chicago,
nobody has a car
where
yet.
You know you just get on the subway and you can go wherever you want. Well, mm-hmm. not in L.A.
Right.
Not in L.A. You need a car.
Yeah. Well, this has been really fascinating. I'm really thankful that you took some time out of your day to talk with us. Karen usually has some fun questions that she likes to end our podcasts with to get a little personal insight into the folks that we've been interviewing. So,
hey, Mike, Karen, like my favorite swear words and stuff? I mean,
oh, no, not usually. I don't think that's in the list yet, but perhaps we'll add that.
Okay.
So if a bartender was going to name a drink after you, what would it be called?
If a bartender was going to name a drink after me, that's sort of an interesting question. Jump into an open grave.
And what would be in this drink?
Everything.
That's like the worst Long Island iced tea known to man.
Everything. And put a little bit pineapple in it, too.
All right.
Well, yeah. It's all about the garnish, of course.
Right,
That makes life interesting, right?
Right.
Oh, that's fantastic. Let's see. Let me pick another one from the list. We already talked about that. I can't ask you that question.
Yeah, he covered a lot of stuff without us
having
to ask. Yeah,
we kind of ranged far and wide with that. Do you know any tricks?
Do I know any tricks? Any magic tricks?
Magic tricks, people tricks.
I know how to get from Westwood to Venice by taking Ohio.
Whoa.
Okay.
Okay.
Also, I have my three bean salad secret recipe. And the secret is I use a fourth bean.
Oh, that's fantastic. All right, and then finally.
Hello?
Did I lose you?
Yes. Hello?
I think we lost Karen.
Oh,
no.
Boy. Just before the big question.
The final question, yes.
Yeah. We'll never know.
I'll do a filler. She'll be back in a minute. Her internet does this once in a while. But I'm going to do a filler question. If you were on a deserted island, you could only take one book with you, what would it be?
Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole.
Nice. That was too quick. I did have a question going back a little bit. What was that website you said you used to be able to dig up all this timeline stuff?
I think it's called MrPopHistory.com.
MrPopHistory.com. History.
Yeah, one word. MrPopHistory.com.
Okay. I think her last, it would have been book related as well, but I guess we've kind of lost her. So,
how much do I owe in library fees?
That's a good one. All right. Well, why don't you tell people where they can find you on the internet?
They can find me. Well, they can find the book, a website called MeGenerationBook.com. I also have a daily blog called kenlevine.blogspot.com, and I update it every day with humorous pieces and writing advice and things like that. And they can also go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or wherever. The book is available in Kindle version, in paperback version, and audiobook. I do the audiobook. And the name of the book is The Me Generation by Me, Growing Up in the 60s by Ken Levine.
I love that. I might actually get the audiobook version because I like your voice.
Oh, thank you.
And if you're reading the book, then that would make it interesting.
Yes, I'm reading the book.
That's really cool. Well, I certainly would love to have you on again as a follow-up later on, if you have other books or if you have other advice for writers or just to chat about growing up in L.A.
Be my pleasure. This was a lot of fun.
You have lots of fun topics that we can cover. And for those of you who are listening on iTunes or on a podcatcher, or we seem to be getting a lot of people that are listening to our podcasts on TV set-top boxes, which I'm not sure how that works, but that's what I've been seeing. So all you people that aren't on our website yet, you want to go to BookGoodies, BookGoodies.com. And do a search for Ken, and you will find the show notes to this podcast where you can go and leave us some comments. Let us know your thoughts about growing up in the 60s or your parents growing up in the 60s and how horrified you are that they did these things. And also, you can click on the Contact Us button up at the top of the page where you can tell us about your book, you can send us a message, and you can request to be a podcast guest yourself. So, Ken, once again, I thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. And for all of you writers out there, sit down, get writing, and have a great day.
Thank you.